No one wants to manage databases if they can avoid it. That's why MongoDB made MongoDB Atlas, a global cloud database service that runs on AWS, GCP, and Azure. You can deploy a fully managed MongoDB database in minutes with just a few clicks or a few API calls. MongoDB Atlas automates deployment, automates updates, handles scaling, and more so that you can focus on your application instead of taking care of your database. You can get started free at mongodb.com/atlas. Now, if you're already managing a MongoDB deployment, Atlas has a live migration service, so you can migrate it easily with minimal downtime and then get back to what matters. Stop managing your database and start using MongoDB Atlas. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Dr. Danae Ford. She is a researcher in the Software Analysis and Intelligent Saint Group at Microsoft. How are you?
I'm good, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm getting there. I'm happy to be chatting with you. I do not have a PhD, and I will tell you, I am intimidated by people with them because it's so fun to get to think and analyze for a living. Did you know that you wanted to think that deeply from the very beginning?
That's a good question. So I didn't always know I wanted a PhD. Actually, that happened throughout my undergraduate research experience. But I knew I liked to think deeply about some problems and be able to analyze data and figure out how we can design systems to build things. So I can give them a laundry list of cool high school projects I did. But I was really interested in helping people and the building systems around them. So apps and things like that in high school. So it kind of really sparked my interest in computer science. So.
Mm-hmm. And when people say think deeply about something, sometimes people like poke at that and they say, you're thinking too much. Like, it's not that hard, right? They'll look at the science of interpersonal reactions, but it is a science. Like, there are scientific methods, are there not, to make people get along better, work in teams better, include people in teams better. It's not just, hey, y'all, relax. It's not that big of a deal.
Oh yeah, for sure. We're definitely applying the scientific process for these things where we're identifying strategic research questions or we're carving out those areas so we can build the research questions and design the correct methodology to figure out what's the best way to approach this question or based on whatever answers we're interested in. So a lot of my work takes a mixed methods approach where it's qualitatively identifying and then quantitatively validating to understand the challenges that programmers face when they're asking for help. The mechanisms that they use to help them encourage participation, and from there, designing on-platform mechanisms to encourage that desired participation. So my work is at the intersection of software engineering and human-computer interaction and online community. So it's important to be able to design methodologies that are responsive to those, my goals.
So the intersection between those two spaces. So your PhD is in computer science, but you also have a focus on cognitive science. Is that is how the brain thinks and works?
Yes, that is exactly how the brain thinks and works. So I was really excited about doing this graduate minor in cognitive science. Something I always wanted to do in undergrad, but I didn't really have quite the time because I was an athlete and trying to finish computer science in 4 years. So it was important for my research area as I was blossoming to be able to understand how people learn about systems, how they learn, how they interact with one another, and how does it influence their technical output. So the graduate minor gave me a little bit more insight into how those things work, especially for eye movements, things like that.
Eye movement. So that one is the one that I think is like, you have a ton of publications. And by the way, like, it may not seem like fun to the folks that are listening, but if you discover a cool PhD, I like to collect PhDs and like share them like Pokemon. Like, have you read this paper? You know what I mean? Have you seen Dr. Ford's work? Because you are very prolific and a number of your papers are really, really actually really interesting to read, which I don't think that the lay person would think, hey, yeah, reading PhD papers is super fun. It actually is. But the eye tracking one and the work that you have been doing in the space of eye tracking is interesting. Maybe you could explain what is eye tracking measure and why is it significant?
Yeah. So one study that maybe mentioning is a study I did to understand how developers reviewed contributions. So how they reviewed pull requests on GitHub.
Okay.
And the reason we wanted to figure out was that there was a lot of hypotheses or people were speculating about how social signals would be used or if they're important or not and how we evaluate our technical contribution of a pull request, where ideally the technical contribution should just be the code, right? The code snippet, period. Don't even look at the comment. Don't even look at the issue commit, the issue that this may have been attached to. And I wanted to design a study to figure out if that was really the case, how developers actually reviewed pull requests and versus what they actually said. So what they reported, I should say.
Interesting. So sometimes I feel like naysayers in the space of inclusion are just like, hey, it's just code. Like everybody can write code. Why are we worrying about people and personalities and race and gender and faces like that? They try to dismiss these things because like you're saying, the only thing that should matter is the code. Are you saying that if there is additional peripheral context around a pull request, that can affect how I might react to the pull request?
Oh, for sure. So what I'll say is that, so for the study, we were using this I-my hypothesis that if people are looking at this content, then they are attending to it, as in it is on their mind. Not to say that it's using this I-my hypothesis, not to say that they are, is a distinct factor or significant in their decision process, but we know it is of value in some way, period, right? So the point of the experiment was to see how people are using that information. So if GitHub is truly, or how we do pull requests and how we review that whole code review process, if it's truly a meritocracy, nothing else should matter than the code. What we found out actually was that after doing a pre and post survey, in addition to the study of reviewing these pull requests of an identifiable woman, identifiable man, and an unidentifiable person, that people do actually use the avatar image, which is very small on the pull request, the single commit of a pull request page. It's a very small area, surface area there. But all our participants reviewed that information, even though only one reported that it was valuable to them in some way, right? So whether or not we are aware that we're using this information, we are attending to it. And it's important that to note that this is our way of understanding the unconscious decisions that we're making and value structures that we have. So for another one, a part of that was looking at, let's see, the technical peripheral content, such as the commit message, this person's previous projects, their pinned projects, their rate of contribution. So the contribution heat map, these are all examples of technical peripheral information you're asking about that are of value to code reviewers.
Okay. I feel like there's a ton to unpack there. And if you don't mind, I want to roll back over a couple of things.
Please.
And I want to hit them for the audience and for myself. So first thing you talked about was, and you said it very fast, the I-mind hypothesis.
Yes.
So what is that hypothesis? What is the relationship or the postulate that is making from the way the eye and the mind develop information that comes in?
Right. So the postulate there is that the way we understand the world, the way we process information, mm-hmm. one way of doing that is through our eyes, through mm-hmm. vision. As in that's our way of taking in content. And we use this tool of vision in order to understand the world and sure. to make our decisions. For pull requests, it is for reviewing code on your desktop, the tools you have to do that, you only have your vision, right? And your cursor. Mm. And that's all the only tool you're using to digest that information. So right. that's the tool that was used to measure how much of interest the content was. And again, can't really distinguish the value, right? Based on the study that we were doing, there were some additional factors to manage that. But the I-my hypothesis, again, is you are attending to what you're looking at, as in you are taking in what you're looking at that is of consideration.
Okay. So paraphrasing it for my understanding, mm-hmm. it doesn't say, oh, this person rejects women's pull requests because clearly their eye goes to the profile picture, or this person rejects pull requests of a certain race because they look at that. It is simply an acknowledgement that what their eye fixates on is part of the processing. Doesn't make any qualitative judgment. It simply tracks the quantity, like, oh, they glanced there. That's a thing. There was no lag between what they fixated on and what they processed.
Right. So also in addition to that, we did see quite a bit of fixation on these areas, right? So that also indicates it is of importance or is of some type of value system, right? Mm-hmm. To say, so you can use the fixation, so that's the when people focus on a certain area of interest, and in mm-hmm. combination with the scan path, which is a series of fixations to be able to understand what other values or what other areas of interest contribute to making a decision, right?
Yeah, interesting. And that's something for folks to think about. So you might be thinking as you're listening to this show that like there are judgment calls that are being made or that someone is going to judge you based on what you look at when you're looking at a pull request. But we know that gaze techniques are used to make people look at ads. Like layouts of popular websites and news sites are set up to optimize for what they want you to look at. Like the environments that are man-made versus ones that are natural are treated differently. Like you have to say, this was a designed page. Did my eye go where it needed to go to do what I needed to do? Was this page optimized for my task?
Right, right. Exactly. So this is no slight at the designers of GitHub. This is how we review code, right? These are signals that are available to us. So you go to somebody's main profile page, the avatar image is fairly large and you have the rate of contribution so you can use it as your CV, essentially. You know, this can be comparable to how we evaluate technical contributions in other spaces. This is the norm that we've set for understanding other people who may be contributing to our work. Mm-hmm. So figuring out how that translates is important.
Now, in the 80s, an eye fixation study was done by someone named Carpenter, and I've heard the term carpentered environments. Is that a coincidence, the idea of a created environment versus a natural environment?
Well, that's actually a coincidence, I think. I'm not really sure. That's a good question.
The reason I ask is that, you know, eye fixation and comprehension was done in the 80s by Patricia Carpenter at Carnegie Mellon. And then I hear about carpentered environments, which is just a way of saying environments that have been built, except it's used with a lowercase c. So I was kind of curious if Patricia Carpenter had kind of like come up with that, or that was just a total coincidence.
I don't know. I would say that maybe there's a great coincidence. I know that the work that I normally cite for the IMI hypothesis is Justin Carpenter, so Patricia Carpenter. Mm. But that is actually really interesting. I mean, but also this IMI hypothesis would apply to other spaces as well, even beyond man-made systems, right? And so the same way if you're looking out your window and you see a butterfly, right? Or you're following the path, right? It's the equivalent of like the IMI hypothesis that I'm referring to for code review.
So. Indeed. And your paper talks about how, you know, one's attention has to be sustained and focused. One is by in programming and thinking and analyzing a pull request or doing anything with code requires sustained attention. So then it makes sense that eye gaze and the, what did you call it? The path, the scan path.
Yes.
Would be very valuable data.
Yeah.
So you're drawing a relationship between the shifts of attention and this thing called a saccade. What is a saccade?
Oh, saccade. People pronounce it many different ways. Saccade, saccade. Okay. One way to understand the saccade that people make is when people are focusing on an area and your eye, in order to capture the entire area, your eye movements are doing a set of quick movements, actually, in order to understand a full experience. So I'll give an example. When you're reading a sentence on paper, the way you read it in the U.S., in the American natural language, is from left to right.
Of course.
And when you're taking in the sentence, when you're reading, you would find that your gaze does a little bit of a couple skips, right? You're skipping over areas because you kind of have a grip on what those words are and your brain is trying to understand the rest of the passage. And in the actually have a video, obviously can't show on podcast, but I have a link on my blog.
I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, I have a link on my blog that actually shows that even before one of our participants could review a pull request or could confirm out loud the decision to accept or decline or merge or not merge this pull request, they do a series of saccades when they're focusing on areas. So when they're looking at the actual code snippet for review, they're doing a bunch of quick little jumps around that area as a way of reading, right? And the scan path that you can consider is the series of those movements for different areas of interest.
Interesting. One of the things that we think about is we want to think about our bias, our implicit bias, our internal bias. And you didn't just go and say, well, this is about women and men. You also had an icon, an avatar that was just one of those blobs, one of those generated gravatars.
Yeah.
But you also looked at the Git graph, that green graph at the bottom, which I think makes me feel guilty about myself, like I'm not working hard enough. But I started to realize after reading your papers that I am applying a huge amount to that green graph, indicating that, well, they must know what they're doing. Because it's really green at the bottom there.
Right.
And I don't know if that's a good bias or not, but you had me, because I thought about this, I realized, wow, my eye is consistently drawn to this big green blob.
Right.
What do I do with that? Like, now that you've told me that this is a thing, I don't know. Do I do anything at all?
Well, I mean, it's important to acknowledge that, you know, that we all have these systems that are set up and the mm-hmm. biases of how we interpret these pages, right? And mm-hmm. we get in our own rhythm and cadence of how to interpret those things. The green large graph, the contribution graph, heat map, as mm-hmm. I sometimes call it, is at the center right. of the page, depending on, you know, it's at the center, slightly to the right, but in the middle of the page. Mm-hmm. So it's naturally gravitates your attention. And those items that are larger will also do that as well. Especially there's something that my colleagues were bringing up as this ability for humans to focus on a face or to search and identify a face. So that's also like a threat, right? If you're looking for someone like you, right, you're trying to identify how normal something is, you're going to be drawn to the face, right? If your establishment of normal is to say, oh, their productivity is important, the contribution heat map is going to be a focus point for you, a focal point. So, but it's also funny that you mentioned the contribution heat map because people can game that. People draw cute little figures and try to intentionally contribute on certain days and X amount of times on certain days so it can write hi or a cool message on their profile page.
Which is a really great point. So if I were using that to judge whether or not I would hire someone or interview them, I can't trust it. It's an unreliable narrator, just as the avatar is an unreliable narrator. It could be a Simpsons character, as far as I know.
Exactly. Exactly. Actually, in this study, we also, not in this paper that we published, but there's a part of a larger study, we also do this implicit association test to be able to understand. So this is the Harvard implicit association test, where anyone can actually go online and test to see what their associations with gender science or gender career would be. And we actually had our participants go through that as well. And that's kind of upcoming in another study, but to see how that can influence afterwards, after they complete the code review process, how that influenced their decisions. And we all have biases. So we had a lot of women who also ran the gamut, right, of associating men with computer science and women with liberal arts.
Hey, friends, you know how I love great podcasts, and I want you to check out the Code Newbie podcast. It's all about stories from folks on their coding journey. They talk to new developers, experienced developers, and everyone in between about how they got started learning to code, how they navigate their technical careers, and they also do deep dives into technical topics in a newbie-friendly way. Check out their podcast at www.codenewbie, that's NEWBIE.org/podcast. That's codenewbie.org/podcast. I think that it's important, the whole point of these things and why I like having these conversations is that I think some people feel like this is work that you're using to make me, whoever I am, feel guilty about whatever context I come from. I look at this differently I never thought about it like that. That's a little piece of information that I can file away so that I think when I review, like I catch myself and I go, oh, wow, I didn't realize I was noticing the avatar or I was noticing the graph and not thinking about the code. Why was my eye taken there? And you actually call out in your blog post that the GitHub in 2010 profile page is dramatically different than the redesign in 2018, which is designed to be more friendly and more approachable, but it really actually de-emphasizes activity and it de-emphasizes the code.
Yeah. I mean, even I've seen on Twitter recently, I think a couple developers who are working at GitHub were showcasing some even cooler attributions you can make to your profile page. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's GitHub being like a social coding platform, which is definitely a draw for why people go there. It's just important to note that, you know, maybe this allows people to bring their authentic selves to their whole programming experience now, right? Mm-hmm. So being mindful of that and what that looks like and how that could hopefully build a more inclusive online programming community.
So when you make a study like this or the many other studies that you've done, are you coming up with a hypothesis ahead of time, like I learned in high school science, like I think this is a thing, and then you work for a year to prove that it's a thing or not, and then do you tell us what we should do about that, or do you just leave the conclusion up to the reader?
This is a great question. So my research or my dissertation area kind of does all three of first identifying, looking at previous literature to really understand the area, the research area, but identifying the barriers and challenges that people face in these communities. Mine was focusing initially, on gender, and we identified barriers that exist for people across the gender spectrum. From there, identifying what tools or techniques and mechanisms people are using to kind of overcome those challenges and those barriers. And then the last major phase of my dissertation was the Stack Overflow mentorship program that I worked on with Stack Overflow to devise a better onboarding experience to welcome newcomers or novice question askers and get them help mm-hmm. from expert users. So I like for my research to be able to hit all those points of like, we have to know where we've been to know where we're going. So we have to identify those things and then identify the problem. What are people doing? How can we adapt that at scale or scale-ish? And then do that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And on the Stack Overflow one that you did, you called out that if women ask a question on Stack Overflow for the first or second time and the reply comes from someone who's identifiably a woman, they feel somehow more welcomed and they're more likely to come back, which I think is what I always like to say is if technology looks like the mall, which I like going to the mall, I like the way the mall makes me feel. I like the way downtown Manhattan makes me feel because it's people from everywhere. If Stack Overflow, if online communities, wherever they are, feel like that, then everyone feels better and everybody wins.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm really trying to figure out how to recreate those feelings, right? And that exact product you mentioned was with women, but what does it mm-hmm. look like for culture, right? So mm-hmm. on Stack Overflow, they don't actually collect data about, or it's not self-reported about your gender. Or right. But you do have access to what country you're from. People can self-report what country they're from. So maybe if I'm a developer from Egypt and I see other developers from Egypt engaging in the community, it's kind of like, okay, I have a shared identity with someone, right? I can see mm-hmm. that. I can see a bit of myself in them, the references they use when trying to clarify programming problems. And it's like, mm-hmm. oh, okay, I see that there's a space for me here. And we want to figure out how we can recreate those.
It's funny that you say that because there's all these little things that make up one's identity, where they grew up, where they went to high school. Like, we all know how we feel. And it's like, oh, you went to my high school? Did you know so-and-so? And then suddenly someone who was a stranger 5 minutes ago isn't, right?
Right.
And one of the aspects of my personality or my identity is that I'm a type 1 diabetic, mm-hmm. but it's invisible. It's not a thing you see. But I have tubing, I have medical implants, I've got a number of needles and tubes and things and batteries that are all over me. But if you don't see them, they're not a thing. But if I am out in the world or I'm at a conference or whatever and I see someone else's tubing coming out underneath their clothes, I'll go and I'll touch them on the arm and I'll go, hey, and I'll show them my insulin pump. And then we will clink our pumps together, kind of like, you know, when you go cheers and you clink glasses together. Yeah. And it's like suddenly a total stranger is a friend and then we're talking about our journey with this invisible disability. And it sounds silly, but if I give a talk and I'm like, how many diabetics are in the house? And like five hands go up. It's like, ah, my people.
Right.
That's a good feeling. And there's so many different ways. It could be, hey, people from Portland, or hey, former Microsofties, or hey, whatever. And that's a nice feeling. And we should make everyone feel like that.
Right. And that's a different side of inclusion that sometimes people don't really, isn't as clear. Right. Isn't. Mm. And I think it's something that's really easy to highlight and allowing us to understand that there are shared identities in people who even don't look like you. Right. So you talked about with the diabetic experience. Right. You mm-hmm. knew you saw their cord coming out their shirt and you're like, oh, let's connect. That doesn't necessarily mean that person was also like also from America or also a white person or also a man, you know. So I think it's important to acknowledge that there are different ways to amplify those shared differences and those shared experiences that add value to those who feel marginalized, who are marginalized. But the point is to not just have them in their corner doing their own thing, but to allow them to feel like they're a part of the group at large, mm-hmm. the community at large.
Definitely. I want to shift gears a little bit because there is a thing that's been going on Twitter a lot lately when we talk about whiteboard programming, going and sitting and like, hey, we're going to come work at the company. You're going to work on machine learning, Dr. Ford. You're going to do all kinds of really important data work. But before you do that work, I want you to draw a for loop on the whiteboard. Like, why do we insist on having people write code on a whiteboard and have trivia questions when it's universally hated and tends to be a little bit exclusionary?
That is an age-old question. I wish I knew the answer to that. I wish I knew the answer to that.
Easy? I mean, I don't know.
I think it's because I think, so when we're in our developing settings, like as a developer, my past, super past life, mm-hmm. you go to the whiteboard to brainstorm those ideas. That's some people's main interpretation or main approach to be able to explain their ideas. Mm-hmm. That does not work for everyone.
Yeah.
That takes practice. So even for technical coding interviews, people practice for those. People practice being able to speak their ideas as they're writing them on the board. That is not an innate skill that people have.
That right there, like, let me just pause you for a second. Like, people need to drink that in for a second. You know how when you find out that someone can't roll their tongue and you're like, what? Are we even related? You can't roll your tongue like that? And like, oh, well, no, I just never thought that was a thing. Like, I found that out about one of my kids recently. I don't know the genetics of it, but I got to make a call. But when I discovered that not everyone can talk and move at the same time, like think and express, and, you know, I'm thinking and here's what's happening in my head right now. It's a synchronous thing versus an asynchronous thing. Mm-hmm. Why would I then exclude those people accidentally or inadvertently?
Right. Exactly. This is exactly what happens. So the one reason or one approach to even doing this is figuring out what is this person's main form of communicating. So most developers code at the IDE, right?
Yeah.
Why aren't most of our technical interviews? I mean, a lot of people are transitioning to this mode of giving someone a project and letting them work on it remotely and then submit their project so that they can use whatever resources work best for them. Mm-hmm. And that's a great best practice, right? But how do we recreate that in person if people want people to come in and also have the behavioral part of the interviews, but also have, I need you to work on this technical task real quick?
Yeah. One of the things that we've tried to do in the developer division of the last couple of years is reboot our interview process such that we actually have people come in and work on a thing side by side with the actual people they'd be working on the thing with. And the challenge is, of course, you don't want to accidentally get free work from them. So that's the thing. Like, you know, don't come in and work for a week for free. We'll take your work and then do a thing. But at the same time, is the work you're being given in the interview representative of the work you'd be doing every day?
And most likely, no. Most of the time, no, because you're connecting with the team. I can talk briefly about some work from home findings that, so another project I'm working on right now is the work from home experience for developers. And one of the main codes, we did a qualitative analysis, a thematic analysis on the responses that we received. And one of that was really interesting was the collaboration part of being at the whiteboard, as in being at the whiteboard with others, not just yourself. Being able to explain new ideas, new projects. So we've all been working from home for quite a while now, at least for the COVID-19, the Puget Sound, Pacific Northwest greater area. And people were previously working on old projects that were wrapping up, already had goals outlined. What does it look like now to outline a new goal when your main media of doing that is lost, is no longer shared?
See, so true story, I have always been remote at Microsoft, but half my team is usually in Redmond. So while most of my experiences have been kind of over Skype, over Teams, now, just in the last week, I have a team now of 9, almost 10, 10 if you count me. How do I reboot this team? How do I start us thinking? How do I start new projects? How do I get us collaborating? Is it, you know, is it Word or Google Docs or DAW? There are Teams, like there's 15 different ways to do it, but I don't feel like we're getting the same sense of collaboration because our hands are like Novocaine, like they're like numb because these tools are between us and the thing that we want to get out. There's this cognitive load that is there because of our remoteness.
Or the cognitive complexity that's now introduced or it has increased, right? Where it's harder to communicate, right? So that's another aspect of it that you mentioned, like, I'm not trying to like diagnose your problem. But,
no, it's your show.
But the media richness is missing. Like richness of that communication is gone now. So there are alternatives like using the whiteboard on Teams, which I know that some people have used. It's really helpful if you have like a pen, a Surface Pen, or, you know, otherwise it's hard to use your cursor. It wasn't designed. I mean, how do I say this? There is a higher challenge.
There's an impedance mismatch, right?
Yes. Between
a mouse is not a pen. Like, no matter how much Salman Khan from the Khan Academy makes it look like a pen, it's not. So having a real, you know, an iPad with you or a Surface Pen makes a huge difference.
It does. It does.
Interesting. Yeah, I feel like that's a whole other show right there that I got to talk about. Yes. Because one of the things that I've been telling some of the interns, we just had a bunch of interns join, and I wanted to make sure that they knew that it was okay, that this is not remote work. This is something else. But also an acknowledgement. I wonder what you think about this. The lizard brain, my lizard brain, knows you are not here. We are having a conversation on a podcast over a collaborative technology, but you can't see me gesticulating with my hands. You can't see me nodding. The linguistic back channel is limited to me going, when if you were here, we would be vibing because I'd be like, oh, yeah, you see my eyes. That's not here. And on Teams, it's two-dimensional, and it's not normal to look at 9 people at a time on a screen. That's not how people lay it, sit out on a desk, and it's not comfortable, you know, to talk to yourself in a room. The lizard brain knows I'm talking to myself right now in a room.
The lizard brain. That's what's getting me, the lizard brain.
Maybe that's the wrong thing to say. I mean, you're the scientist. It's like the part of the brain that's not conscious makes, like, you know, when you get out of an airplane and you're like tired and you're like, I don't know why I'm tired. I just sat the whole time. The body knows.
Yes. 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 I mean, there's also aspects of that that are draining, right? I mean, we were talking about, this is not just remote work. This is remote work during a pandemic. There is a crisis happening. So what this means is that what's happening outside of your work has always been important, right? Your work-life balance or what's happening with your life, always been important. Right now, it's
I can hear the kids eating each other upstairs just right now. Sorry. I don't know if that came through the microphone, but someone has just body slammed someone else. I'm sorry.
Sorry, I still love WWE.
It's just the perfect metaphor for what we're talking about.
Though. Pandemic. That is a crisis happening upstairs. You should go handle.
I need to take the broom now and like take the broom handle and pound the top of the ceiling.
But yeah, it's a crisis happening and your mind knows that. Every time you close the computer and walk over to use the restroom, you're like, this is not the usual like hallway I used to walk down after work to get a break. Right. You don't. So you don't get in the car to go or get on the bus or however you commute to work, which sometimes is your signal that you have completed the end of workday. Right. Oh. That boundary is blurred and is unclear. And people are coming up with their own rhythms and cadences to figure out how to show the end of the workday or to make themselves feel like they've ended the workday, come up with their new establishments of norms. But it looks different for everyone. And it's an ongoing challenge.
That is a huge problem. Right now, if I stick my head out the door or use the restroom, you're done working. No, I just need to use the restroom. It would be better if they didn't see me because Daddy's here. He's in the house somewhere. He wants to hang out with us, right?
Right.
And but that is just, it all makes you feel bad.
Yeah, but also, I mean, there's also advantages to being close to your family now, right? You have, maybe there's moments you can help them with their homework now, or you get to help them with different playing baseball or something in the backyard, right? So there's the advantages of family proximity as well. And then there's disadvantages where it feels like, well, I'm not giving them enough attention. Like I'm here, but I'm not physically here with them.
Yep.
Or helping them. So yeah, there's a lot to consider here too.
There is a lot to consider. And I really appreciate you chatting with me today, Dr. Danae Ford.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. Happy to be here.
You can check out the publications, blogs, and all the interesting stuff that Dr. Ford is working on at her website at danaeford.me. I'll make sure that there's a link to the show notes, to the things that we've talked about and the papers that she's worked on. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.